It is really good to be here. I've been excited for this probably for about 2 years now. I'd actually been asked previously, but I wasn't quite prepared, and I'm going to share a little bit of what my journey has looked like over the last 3 years with you, and maybe that'll help to explain. But I got to say, so often when we hear the worship songs, if you took snippets of them and you tag them together, it's an amazing message, right? Like, I was just, hi, Jody. You know, I'm going to do that a few times today where I'm going, oh, that person's here. Oh, they're here, kind of thing. So, in your kingdom, broken lives are made new. Come have your way among us. Fears are washed away. There's two that really resonated. Every sin on him was laid in this last song. And then, who made the orphan a son and daughter? Done. Amen. Right? Well, you're not going to get that lucky. I've got more to say. So, this church family, and I know I said it the last time I was here, and I actually mean it even more this time than I did last time, where this church family is, you guys, and you can't tell other churches I said this, okay? But it seems like you get it. Like, when I come here, I feel like I'm stepping into an environment where I'm released. Actually, I feel this. There's a couple of churches. I'm going to say one because Peter was part of that one, too. That was Cornerstone in Crystal City. But he'll remember a story that I shared. I'm not going to go there, but he got to finish that story for me that Sunday. And it's amazing how if we allow God to work in our lives and we say something and somebody else later will come up to you and say, hey, did you know this part? You're like, I didn't know that part. And it shouldn't surprise us because the story isn't finished. None of our stories are finished. Even when we're dead, it's not finished, right? So, as it turns out, the person that I was going to haul up on stage, Kelly Wheeler, is not here today. I know you're thinking, what a jerk, right? No, Kelly is doing what Kelly does. He models and represents Jesus so well. Today, this morning, there is a celebration happening. One of the kids from the youth center is getting baptized. And this has been a crazy journey. And I'd like to kind of be there, but I'm not, because this is where I made a commitment, and I actually really want to be here. But part of me wants to be there. Something that I want to take you on a bit of a journey with me on is sort of the concept, and I've shared this in other contexts, but it just turned out so differently this time. But you guys set me up so beautifully for this message. I wanted to talk a little bit about how we live lives so often looking into our rearview mirror. So we're more concerned about what's there than what's there. And today, you celebrated Promotion Sunday. Do you know how I looked forward to Promotion Sunday every year? As a kid growing up in church, partially because the way that I was, my nature, my personality, the teacher was also happy that it was Promotion Sunday, right? But I was looking forward to growing up, and by getting into the next class, that meant I was growing up. And that excited me. Kelly has been part of Youth for Christ in Morden for 12 years. I've only been there 11 and a half years. He's just like one of those, the rocks, right? And when kids talk about him, I've never heard anything bad about him. I've heard firm things. Oh, he really challenged me. Or, John, Kelly said this, is this right? And I'm, yeah, it's right. Yeah, I thought so. You know, they believe him. It's just so cool. Ernie Wheeler is here, and he has been connected with that. And that's a uncle and a nephew, and it's kind of cool how even that makes sense somehow, right? Like, there's something about genetics that plays a role. And as a result of that, sadly, I have job security because genetics plays a role. And it's sad, right? When I look up, and I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at all these kids here, I don't mean this in a bad way, and I think you'll get it. I hope I never see them in my building, unless they're volunteering, right? Another person that we're really excited for is the newest board member from this church family. Only it hasn't happened yet. Think on that. We actually prayed quite a bit at our last board meeting, and we really felt like we wanted someone from this church family to take on that role. We've been praying into that, and it doesn't mean that it's a yes, but we're hoping it's a maybe, and we're hoping somebody is coming and saying, you know what, John? Oh, I've thought of it before, but I didn't know if I had the gifts to offer. And usually when a person comes like that, they probably have the gifts to offer, right? When they're coming in humility. I love that. I want to share part of the journey that I don't share it lightly. It's something that when I recount this part, it happened about 3 years ago. Some of you have heard aspects of this story before, but it was humbling. It was actually discouraging. It was probably the darkest place that I've been in my life. And it started on what was a beautiful summery day. It was in the end of May, early June. Janelle, my wife, and I were driving back from Winnipeg. I'd taken a rare day off work because, you know, God can't do anything without John Rempel. And we're driving back, and we had a really good day. We went to Mongo's for lunch. I love Mongo's. It's healthy, and you can eat lots. And, oh, it's so good. And we watched a matinee, which we hadn't had a chance to do for a long time. And we were driving home. And I'm driving there, and all of a sudden I feel this sweat, and I felt my forehead. I was like, it felt greasy, it felt cold, it felt not right. And all of a sudden I started shaking, and hyperventilating, and I was just like, Janelle, there's something going on here. I don't know what it is, but there's something going on here. And so I pulled over to the side of the road, and I couldn't collect myself, and as a guy with your wife, you don't want to look weak. You don't want to look like a doofus, you know. And so you're trying to collect yourself. You're just trying to force yourself into a better place, but it wasn't working. I said, you know, Janelle, why don't you keep driving? I'm going to go to the back of the van. I'm going to just crash in the back seat, and I'm just going to do some recovery. And when I got home, I felt okay. And I thought, oh, okay, you know what? Maybe it was something I ate. You know, I was trying to recount what it might have been, but nothing came to my mind other than, I don't think you're healthy, John. But I didn't want to say anything. The next morning, I call up my friend, Paul Penner. He works at the Pemina Counseling Center. Great guy. And I thought, you know what? I want to bounce something off of him if he's around, right? So I phoned in, and he gets on the phone, and I said, hey, Paul, wondering if you'd have a few minutes to see me this morning. I was struggling with something. And he said, yeah, come on down. So I went to his office. And his office was a disaster. I was like, what is going on here? And he says, well, I just started sabbatical about a week ago, and I'm just cleaning up and throwing files that I don't need, so I'm just cleaning up before I can, you know, leave. Like, well, why did you even see me then? Like, if you're on sabbatical, you're on a break, you're on a leave, you need this as much as I need this kind of thing. He says, you know, John, this morning God was talking to me, and he said, you're going to get a lot of calls this morning. The only one you take is if John Rempel phones. He had my attention, and in that heartbeat, I just started weeping. It was like this was supposed to happen. Something is lining up here, but I couldn't put a finger on it, right? But I got to keep going. And we chatted for a couple of hours, and he referred to my situation as either an anxiety attack, adrenal fatigue, you're going a little bit nuts, he said. You know, and we have enough of a relationship that hearing that actually felt good, because I felt like I was going a little bit nuts. And I thought, oh, okay, that makes me normal in a nutty way, but normal, right? And so here's kind of the process that I took from that place. I'm going to tell you one thing first. Just before I left his office, he says, is there someone that you really trust, that you think wouldn't judge you if you just said this right now? And I mentioned the name. And he's like, whoa, I didn't expect that name. And I said, me neither. I don't even know this person. And I thought, okay, whatever. So I'm leaving the office, his office, and I'm driving down by Olympic Sports, whatever street that is, 9th or whatever, and probably Nelson. And so I'm driving down there, but there's a truck blocking the way. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, I better turn down the back lane so I can get around. Well, there's a vehicle blocking that back lane. And I thought, what are the odds in Morden that two streets are blocked at the same time, right? But they were. So then I backed up, and I thought, okay, I'm going to go this way. And I went all the way down to Thornview, groceries there. And the person that I had just mentioned to Paul, the guy that I would trust, drove in front of me. And if I would have taken the street before, if I would have gone the back lane, I would have missed him. So as he's driving by, I'm doing one of these. You know, and because it was just this striking hit in the heart, right? And so he went like this. He motioned this way. So I pulled up to him, and I got to share what happened. And this is like one of those stories that keeps going. He says, that is hilarious. He says, you know that I ran about 10 minutes late, and I'm late for a lunch appointment with somebody, and I was feeling so bad. It's Paul Penner. And again, here's this blubbering idiot in the front seat of a vehicle, right? I just started bawling. It was like, no way, God, in the middle of what this is looking like, oh, you're powerful. So, next step was I went to see my medical doctor, and my medical doctor, I really trust him. I actually used to sell medical supplies, and he was my first doctor that I got to help set up his practice. We got along really well. It was fun. And as a result of his integrity and what he modeled, he became my doctor. And this would have been 30-some-odd years back, right? And so I went to see him, and he's looking at me, and he says, you know what, John? I could have told you this about 2 or 3 years ago, but I saw this coming. But he says, you ministry people don't listen. You will always say, yeah, God's got me covered, or no, what you see isn't real, whatever. This is coming from a guy that is not a Christian and does not want to be connected with Christianity. And he's telling me, you ministry people. It's like, okay, you got my attention, right? He says, you have what is called adrenal fatigue. And this is what he compared it to. He says, if you're driving a vehicle and you've got gasoline in the vehicle, and once the gas is almost out, you can actually run on the fumes, the vapors of that fuel for a little bit, right? It just can. But once the vapors are gone, they're gone. Your vehicle cannot move anymore. He says, people have been built, designed in a way. So here he's describing how God has designed us without a Christian perspective, right? He says, we're designed in a way that we have a certain amount of adrenaline that we can draw from each day. But you cannot draw on the adrenaline for the next day and have adrenaline still left for the next day. If you tap in too deep to your adrenal gland, it will steal resources from the next day. So he says, now you're this car that's running on adrenaline a bit. But you cannot run on the vapors of adrenaline because there are no vapors of adrenaline. And he says, not only that, John, you're running on the thought of vapors of adrenaline. You have depleted your resources so badly. He says, I am tempted right now to move you, I think he said, the sixth floor at Health Sciences, which is the psych ward. He says, John, you are so unhealthy. I can't believe you walked in here. Something else is sustaining you. So even in that, what wasn't really a good message to hear, something else is sustaining you. Coming from a non-Christian. I was like, yeah, there is. And he says, I don't know why, but I don't even think I want you to be medicated. I think somehow you're going to get through this. I was like, oh, yeah, but how come I feel so bad? So then he actually prescribed me a couple of counselors. I say a couple because the first one didn't work out and the second one didn't work out. What happened, and now you'll know what ministry people look like from the other side of the fence kind of thing, but I went to see this one person, and I started sharing what I was going through, and all of a sudden she stops me. She says, you're so good at explaining this. Do you mind if we switch chairs for a while? Because I've really been struggling with... No! Okay, the first time that happened, I was really angry. The second time it happened, I just laughed because it was another person that did the exact same thing. And in both cases, I went to their boss and I said, you got broken people working for you. Yep. And I thought they were going to be mad at me. In both cases, though, they thanked me because they had been addressing this with their bosses. But their bosses were saying, no, no, you're good. You're good. You'll work through it. Well, how can you work through it if you can't work through it? Right? So that didn't work out. I called my doc back and said, yeah, that sucked. What else you got for me? And then he set me up with a psychiatrist in Winnipeg whose first name was Shalom. Yes. So I went to see this guy, and immediately I just took to him. He was brilliant. He understood how a person thinks and how they walk and how they journey. And the first question he asked me, and I thought this was interesting, because he said, okay, you're in ministry, and I want to know, how many Facebook friends do you have? And I said, well, I don't know offhand. He says, yeah, you do. You know close. I said, well, probably about 1,500. He says, let's look. So we looked it up. It was 1,560. He says, you're an idiot. I was like, well, how does that make me an idiot? He says, who needs 1,560 friends? I said, I didn't invite them. Like, I go speak at an event or this, and then people add me. He says, so you don't know them? I said, well, yeah, I know them. Otherwise, I wouldn't let them add me. He says, you know 1,560 people? I was like, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, who doesn't? Kind of thing, right? Because that's, and really, if we thought about it, we all do, right? But he says, you have a mega church and you're a single pastor. Shame on you. It's like, ooh, that kind of clubbed me, right? And he says, I have one assignment for you. And this was the end of that meeting. We talked Facebook, and then he gave me an assignment, and I want to see you next week. But his assignment was between today and next week, I want that list down to 10%. 20%. You can have 300. I had it down to 5%. When you start clicking, you go, I don't need to pretend a relationship with this person. I don't need them to lean on me, because there was a lot of it happening. It was crazy. That's a longer story, right? But he got me to reposition my thinking. He got me to think about how much I was looking into my rearview mirror. I was trying to move forward, but you know, if this is your mirror and it's here and you're trying to move forward, but all you're doing is looking at your footsteps behind you, but you're also seeing what's coming up behind you. I shared this, actually, the first time I shared this, and it might have been a bit soon. I don't know. It was at the men's prayer breakfast on a Friday morning, and some of you guys were there. But I'm sitting on a stool, I'm starting to talk, and I'm starting to share, and all of a sudden I'm like, and so bear with me, this is what I did. This is my reality, and this is how I'm feeling, but I'm going to keep sharing my testimonial because this is as real as it gets, but right now I feel like hyperventilating, I feel like I'm not quite there, and so then all of a sudden I collected myself again, and then I start sharing again, and then for a second time I was like, okay, yeah, I get it. Okay, Lord, I get it. And I'm on the floor in a bar, because that's what it is at Rock's Bar and Grill, and I've never been on the floor of a bar before, right? But twice I was. But on my walk through the park to Rock's Bar and Grill, I really believe God said, you think you've got this covered. It's not going to be as easy as you think. And you know, I was sitting there after I was done sharing. And quite often, after the breakfast, after you've shared, you know, you get a clap. Well, all I heard was crickets. And I was like, oh, man, did I tank. Wow. And so I just sat there and I was like, okay, I shared. You know, and then we ate breakfast. But then when people started leaving, actually, what struck me, there were a few guys there that said they were there for the first time. And as they were leaving, I had quite a number of men come up to me and say, I struggle with that every day. I've never told anyone. It's like, oh, that would suck. Because John Rempel has always, I've tried to be open. I've tried to be transparent, not because I want everybody to know my failings and stuff like that, but it's me. It's part of who I am, and you get to watch part of my growth. I get to watch part of my growth, but I also wanted people to understand this is not unusual. This isn't something I asked for. It's not something that I said, hey, God, could you please just knock me down? I did say, though, a few weeks earlier, Lord, I know I need to slow down. I don't know how to do it. And I still don't believe God prescribed that for me, but God did allow that to happen. And for 8 months, I had a break. And it was not a break that I enjoyed. So then I started thinking. After the episode at the bar, I said, were other people, and I had to write this down because it was so there. Were other people also struggling with the same stuff? How about at work? Often I hear stories from youth about life situations that have simply been too difficult to get beyond. Not that they wouldn't want to get beyond them. They just didn't possess the tools to do it. When you try to move forward while staying focused on your rearview mirror, it can be impossible. So I'm going to share a few stories. And it's going to be a bit interactive, so I'm going to prepare you now. I've got a few. I'm going to describe the story, and then I'm going to say, so what do you think is in their rearview mirror? And I want you to actually talk to me, because it's going to be talking to each other. Here's the situation. 15-year-old girl. Oh, another thing, when I share these stories, these are stories that I have permission to share. Not the names, but you don't have permission to share. Because this is their story that they've allowed me to share, not you to share. There might be stories, especially where some of the young people are going to go, oh, I know who that person is. And you might, but it's not yours to share. Okay? It's cool? All right. 15-year-old girl. She has a 3-year-old child. So if you do the math, she would have been probably pregnant at 11, baby at 12. Recently had a miscarriage. Often arrives at the drop-in really angry. Like, you'd almost think violently, physically, but it hasn't gone there. But everything else in her demeanor would say that she would. Just on Friday was the 1-year anniversary of her little brother's suicide. At the end of the evening, she will almost always leave happy. Not with words, she doesn't express them, but there's a change in her disposition. What do you think she's looking at in her rearview mirror? Tell me. What do you think? Hope, hopelessness, right? What else? Hurt. Deep, right? Right to the core. What else? Failure. If you link those three, hopelessness, failure, hurt, what does she have in her life to propel her forward if that is all she's looking at, right? Okay, that's one story. Next story. Just a second. This is driving me crazy. Yeah, I'm one of those. Okay. Just turned 14, young lady. She's the oldest sibling of 4. The other 3 siblings each have a different father, but none of them know who the fathers are. Okay? She'll often bike around town after dark because that's when she feels the safest. She came... At one point, she came to the center and asked if we had any old ketchup bottles or something. And I said, yeah, like you want me to drain them and for a project or something? No, do you have like old ketchup that you wouldn't be using for like hot dogs and stuff? Well, no, but you could use, you know, you could have some of our ketchup. And she says, okay. And I noticed last time that you had some sugar packets. Could I take some of those home? I was like, sure. Like, what's going on? Like a project or something? No. House is empty of food again, so I told my siblings that I'd make them a little bit of soup. Okay, that was interesting. She smokes marijuana at times because she says it calms her down. She recently posted on Facebook, learn from yesterday, live for today, hope for tomorrow. That was the most hopeful thing I've seen her ever write. But without that, what is she looking at in her rearview mirror? Rejection. What else? Sorry?
Poverty.
And what's interesting there is we just think of it, or not we just, we can just think of it as financial poverty. But it's relational poverty. It's scholastic poverty because she doesn't have stuff to do projects with, right? There's poverty. What else do you see in her? Shame. And other words, right? Like you're sort of getting this picture, right? What we did the day that she asked for the ketchup and the sugar packets, we quite often have a little bit of food that we've got stored, and so we gave her some pasta. We happened to have some meat in the freezer, and then a few other things, and we said, hey, why don't you just add these few little ingredients to your ketchup and sugar, right? And she left thinking she's going to have ketchup and sugar soup with a few other things, right? Another girl, also 14, she's had about a half a dozen boyfriends, and each one was love, right? Because once the physical intimacy has crossed a line, she believes that she has them because she has given of herself so personally they couldn't possibly abandon her now, and the exact opposite will happen. The moment that happens, she's discarded, right? She actually confessed to me quite recently. Like, everybody calls her really nasty names. I'll keep this PG rated, but really nasty names, and they will constantly say she is a drug abuser, everything. She came into my office not long ago, and she's like, John, I have never slept with anyone, and I have done marijuana exactly twice, but I tell people I've done those things so much because that way they leave me alone. I don't have to live up to my reputation because it's already running ahead of me, and it's made for me. I have to do nothing. She says, it just makes things easier. So what's in her rearview mirror? Sorry? Fear. What else?
Purity.
Yeah. Oh, she wants so much to be mature. What else? Very low self-esteem. Because she's trying to get it through really inappropriate relationships, right? I'll share one more story and then... Okay, 17-year-old young man, he's fathered a child, he comes to the youth center high every single week, without fail, and he's probably one of the most loving guys that I know, but he experienced a hurt when he lost his sister to an accident, and he was brought up in a very religious community. And they just said, it is God's will that happened. I'm like, how can that be God's will? God doesn't will that. God never willed that. He didn't design death. That wasn't the purpose. We kind of chose it through making poor decisions, and we'd like to blame Adam and Eve, knowing full well that I can be the next Adam. If nobody else sinned, it's going to be me, right? But he had it in his mind that the truth was, somehow the sister deserved this. And how terrible must God be then? And if that's the truth, how terrible must God be, right? And so now he's coming, and he actually, his job ends at 10 o'clock, and he's supposed to shower up and stuff like that because 10:30 we close. But by about 10:06, he's already at the center, and he's shedding all of his work on our floors, which usually takes us a while to clean up, but we're okay with that. But there's something, and between leaving work and getting to the drop-in, he has already used the marijuana, and he's arrived, and now he's just settled. And it's like he's home, he's comfortable. And somehow he can justify all this in his mind, right? But I got lots more here, so I'll try to wind this down. But for him, he's got this distorted view of God in his rearview mirror that God is chasing him, and that if he does anything wrong, God's going to just nail him. He's just going to smack him down. But the songs that we sung today, if we listen to those words, if he were to actually internalize those words, kind of make this transition here, can you imagine how his life could be different? Because I know how different my life was after I made a commitment to Christ. I had a lady that called on a regular basis, and she would say, "Okay, John, how many kids have you led to Christ this year?" And she wasn't meaning it as a, "Hey, how's it going? How many people made Jesus commitments?" For her, it was like, "You better be doing your job." And she had called a few years in a row, and so I heard her voice, and I'm like, "Oh, not again." I never knew how to answer her because I don't know what that looked like. I know some, like I can tell her some stories. And then God gave me this answer that I was not prepared for. And I said, "All of them." She says, "What? We lead them all to Christ. It's what they do with that relationship that's important. It's how they and God interact. We can't make them into Christians." And she said, "I never thought of that before." And I said, "Me neither." Because I hadn't, right? We are in a role, in a job that truly our congregants, our parachurch ministry, the kids actually never leave. Once they start in our system, we are really the only church that they've ever come to know, for the most part. Once they make commitments to Jesus, we don't try to carry them in our environment. We want them to connect with a church family, with a church youth group. How could we not? Because if we were without kids in our building and they were all part of youth groups, praise the Lord. That's a huge victory. That's just not our reality. And so we work hard. And we need these partnerships. We need people that sometimes just redirect our focus a little bit in the right time. Where, like, Ernie will pop in sometimes, and I'll see him walk in, and to me it's like, it's not a troubled kid. It's not a parent that just wants more of my attention. And you might even be judging me right now, thinking, "Well, that's what you should want." Well, of course that's what we want, but not that much. If the tap could just slow down sometimes, it would be good. But when Ernie walks through the door, and you get the hug, and "How's it going?" And, it's just like, It's like a recalibration in that moment. We were really struggling. I was telling Peter here that we were struggling with volunteers. We weren't getting enough. And we had really good ones, but I was really afraid that they were going to just bail because they were working so hard. On a Thursday night, it was not uncommon to have four or maybe five of us. And we would have up to 50 kids some Thursdays. And these are junior hires, which is nuts. And then on Fridays, there we had sometimes only, well, quite often it was George, Kelly, and me. That was it. Great team, knew what they were doing, but it's hard work. And we had asked a lot of leadership, you know, do you have anybody? Do you know of anybody? And, you know, it was like, got nothing. And so we just decided, you know what, we got to pray, and we got to pray, and we got to pray. And then just over a few weeks, our numbers just exploded. In fact, we had four volunteers come from Pembina Valley Bible Camp because during non-camp times, they had time, right? Trevor would remember that. Not that they had tons of time because they're still camp people. But they gave us that Thursday evening. That was huge. So on Thursday, if all of them show up now, we have 14. And on Friday, if all of them show up, we have 8. God did that. We didn't. We just prayed and prayed. But we prayed expectantly, right? When I look at Moses, not just Moses, God's kids, the Israelites, in Exodus, and you picture, like you think, am I the only one that looks at my rearview mirror? But you got Moses, and he's got possibly, they say as many as 2.6 million people at that time that he was leading through this wilderness. Even if even if it's a million people, can you imagine the city of Toronto or whatever following Moses through this desert wilderness for 40 years? They're meandering, right? But they're looking in their rearview mirror and they go, "Moses, really? Really? This is what God took us out of Egypt for? Like, really? We want to go back. Just let us go back." And we get that story often. The kids will just say, "I wish I could just go back. I wish I could just go back." They don't have that option. I don't have that option. When I describe to you just that little glimpse of what I went through, remember, I had God. I had like the biggest shoulder to lean on. The kids that we serve, they don't have this Jesus relationship. They haven't been introduced to Father. And the fathers that they do have, most of them have no relationship with. But I had God. We want them to have God. We want Jesus' relationships. We want them to take that rearview mirror and smash it. View it as a promotion Sunday. That once this is out of their perspective, out of their line of vision, what are they capable of? Well, we know for one young lady, it was baptism this morning. And how could we not celebrate that? I am so glad Kelly is there instead of here. And there's a number of volunteers that went. Father, we congregate on a Sunday morning, and our desire is to be led into a place of worship. And that can be through song, that can be through word, that can be through watching these awesome children sing praises, and some of it in a language that we don't understand, but we had it interpreted. And we want to see these kids have their own relationships with you. We want to see the kids at the youth center have their own relationships with you too. And for that, there have to be partnerships. There have to be other people that come alongside and say, we're praying for you. And how huge that is. God, you're so big and so personal. So approachable. And for many of us, maybe for most of us, we recognize that more when things weren't going that well. Because you became more real at that time. It seems that's how your people work. Thank you for being God. Thank you for being the constant. We really need that. And each other. Thanks for blessing us, Father. In your name, amen.